Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. New Mexico is a rural, poor state, and it's a constant struggle to get medical care to people who need it. That's particularly true for complex medical conditions, where experts tend to cluster in larger urban areas. But what if, rather than focusing on moving the providers to the patients, you could move more knowledge to the providers who are already in these communities? That's the idea behind a program at the University of New Mexico, Project Extension for Community Healthcare Outcomes, or Project ECHO. It was created 15 years ago at UNM in response to high rates of hepatitis C in the state. ECHO connects doctors and nurses across the state with medical experts at hospitals in urban areas such as Albuquerque via video conferencing. The model has since expanded to cover more than 50 other complex medical conditions at medical centers with 117 partners across the country and around the world. Late last year, President Barack Obama signed the Project ECHO Act. Joining me today is Dr. Sanjeev Arora, who founded Project ECHO in 2003. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Megan.
Why does the ECHO model go beyond what we know as telemedicine?
Telemedicine has been a very successful program in overcoming a geographic divide that may occur between a patient and a specialist. So, for example, if the patient is sitting in Farmington, where there isn't the appropriate specialist, a specialist at the university can see the person on a television screen and prescribe medicines, take care of the patient, save the patient a lot of travel. It is a very useful thing because the patient doesn't have to travel 200 miles, but the fact is no extra patient is really seen in New Mexico. In ECHO, what we do is we say we're going to train primary care doctors and mentor them to manage complex problems in their local communities so that overall the capacity to treat increases dramatically. We call this force multiplication. The shortage of specialist and specialist knowledge in the world is so severe that we believe 6 billion people in the world don't have access to the right knowledge at the right place at the right time. And without the right knowledge at the right place, it is impossible to get the right care. So what we do in ECHO is we take a problem like hepatitis C or addiction, which is one of our largest programs in New Mexico. And since local expertise doesn't exist, we train primary care clinicians, not on a one-to-one basis as occurs in telemedicine, but in a one-to-many. So in a typical tele-ECHO clinic, 25 clinicians can join, primary care clinicians. And we can train them to manage hepatitis C in their local communities through a process which we call case-based learning, where each of them present cases in a de-identified way to each other and to us at the university.
So they bring a case to the clinic.
Yes.
They're protecting the patient's confidentiality, but they lay out the terms of the case and they have a team of experts.
Team of experts, but also their peers around the state help them. So a core principle of ECHO is all teach and all learn. And we spend 2 hours a week with each other. But we've been able to show that over time, they become such experts that when I started this project in 2003, there was a wait of approximately 8 months to see me in my clinic.
You're a liver disease expert.
I'm a liver disease specialist. People were driving hundreds of miles to see me, making 12 to 18 trips for one course of treatment. And if they were poor, they just couldn't do it. But as we started doing ECHO on a weekly basis for 2 hours, we set up 21 centers of excellence all across New Mexico, and the wait in my clinic fell to 2 weeks because the capacity to treat had gone up 5 times, 10 times, or some very large number as patients could be provided the same level of care in their local communities by their local doctors. And we were able to show in a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine that the level of care they were providing was as good as we could provide at the university as long as they were being mentored once a week.
I'm interested in that concept. You said everyone teaches, everyone learns. So the flow of information in these sessions is not just one way, sort of the experts out to the hinterlands. You're all learning from one another?
So that's critical, Megan, because the fact is best practice in medicine does need this highly specialized knowledge, but it also needs the social, cultural, economic context in which patients live. Primary care clinicians understand that. They belong to the same community. They often speak the same language. And this merger of these two types of information creates a care that is actually better then when a person goes 200 miles to see a specialist, you can only imagine if a person, there's a woman who has two children and they have to go to school. She lives in Farmington. She has an appointment in Albuquerque. She's got everything ready to come to Albuquerque, but her car doesn't start, you know, because the car is 15 years old. That appointment is missed. Treatment suffers. Cure rates can decline. Adherence can be poorer. Getting care very far away from where your doctors are can actually impose a cost on the health of the patient.
I'm curious what effect the ECHO model has on doctors and providers and how, in turn, that affects their patients.
One of the real themes that emerges as we have done these publications and studies is that ECHO produces joy of work.
Doctors work extraordinarily hard, and that's I don't hear joy a lot associated with that work. It's important work, but that's interesting.
Yes, it is important, and I think we can do better work when we are joyful while doing it. The types of effect we have shown in the publications is that it reduces professional isolation. It enhances professional satisfaction. It enhances self-efficacy. And it builds a community of practice. So, of course, the knowledge is very important for the care of the patient. But the relationship and the community that ECHO builds, because these clinics are not on the telephone. They are on high-definition video, where all 21, 25 partners can see each other. Over time, strong relationships are built of support and mentoring. So what really creates value in ECHO is the idea of task shifting, where you make trying to make every human being work at the highest level of his human potential. And that happens through a process of interprofessional consultation. That is not just a liver specialist teaching them. There's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a pharmacist. And then the second part is we teach them through a guided practice rather than just giving them a lecture and go do it. But the most important part is the mentor-mentee relationship, which occurs over a long period of time during which the specialist team democratizes their knowledge and transfers it into the minds of these clinicians who then go and do good with it.
How much does it cost to set up an ECHO program?
The primary cost of ECHO is the time of the super specialists. So depending on how many you need, the cost can be variable. There is certainly a cost to the primary care clinicians too, because they, instead of seeing patients for that hour, they are watching a television screen and participating in this community of practice. But most providers in primary care do it because they enjoy the learning, they enjoy the community, and they enjoy the fact that they can provide best practice care to their patients in their local communities. You know, we did a survey, which was published in 2010, where we surveyed primary care doctors in New Mexico in rural areas and asked them, is access to specialty knowledge a major area of need for you? And the answer was 4.9 out of 5. Primary care doctors in rural areas are having a very hard time when they need to consult a specialist to be able to get that consultation on a timely basis.
Have you had to adjust the model?
Yes. So first, when we started this model, Megan, it was predominantly to train doctors and nurse practitioners and physician assistants. But then we also found that in these rural areas, they did not have adequate teams like we had. So for example, an endocrinologist treating diabetes in the university would have a certified diabetes educator, a diabetes nurse specialist, who are also experts, and they manage these patients as teams. But in rural areas, often they don't have the diabetes nurse specialist. They don't have the certified diabetes educators. So we had to evolve the model where we started community health worker programs. So we took these community health workers and made them diabetes specialists. Then we did the same, and we've trained 130 community addiction recovery specialists, helping primary care clinicians take care of their patients with addiction.
Addiction is so complex. Is it difficult with this model to address all the contingencies that people would encounter?
We have set up this program called the Integrated Addiction and Psychiatry Program. So after these people get certified, they actually join an ECHO clinic every week on Friday from 12 to 2, where they present these cases, and we have psychiatrists and counselors sitting. And if they have medical problems, we help them with that. So essentially, yes, you require a village to take care of a patient with addiction. And really, you need lots of specialists. You need a primary care who's engaged. And many times the family has to be engaged. But if a patient is motivated or has an interest in overcoming addiction, this multidisciplinary team is the best chance they have for getting out of this tremendously difficult net in which people get trapped.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with Dr. Sanjeev Arora, founder of Project Echo at the University of New Mexico. We'll get back to him shortly. Dr. Leslie Hayes is a primary care provider with El Centro Family Health in Española. She has used Project Echo's services for many years. She learned how to treat hepatitis C through Echo. Now she focuses on helping people with addictions. She learned how to prescribe Suboxone for opioid addictions and has called on Echo's experts to help her with patients. I asked Dr. Hayes about the effects that Echo has had on her practice over the years.
So I'm in a rural federally qualified health center. We have some specialists in town, and the specialists we have in town are fabulous, but there's a lot of specialists we don't have. And in particular, we don't have psychiatry or addiction up here. It's been really helpful to be able to call and talk to a psychiatrist, or even when I first started, being able to call and talk to Dr. Arora if I had questions about hepatitis C, if I had a patient come into the office.
You don't have addiction specialists or psychiatric specialists in Española, which has traditionally one of the highest overdose rates in the country.
You got it.
Wow. But you're able to call upon this sort of long-distance expertise to help you facilitate this.
Yes, it's really incredible. So there's a lot of stuff I wouldn't have the courage to do if it hadn't been for Project Echo.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I had, you know, a few patients who didn't do well initially when I first started prescribing Suboxone. And I think if I hadn't had Echo backing me up, I might have felt like it was my fault that I was a bad provider. And as it was, I was sort of able to say, okay, you know, they were able to say, no, you handled this properly. It just is sometimes what happens. And so that actually made a really big difference. And, you know, also knowing that I'd talked it over with people ahead of time and they felt this was the right way to manage it. And so I, you know, sort of made me feel less like, you know, I had done something wrong for my patients. One thing that's really nice about Project Echo is they've got more than just medical providers. I mean, there's behavioral health providers, there's community health workers, things like that. Often people will approach it from a completely different angle that I wouldn't have even considered. And sometimes there will be pharmacists or, you know, people from different specialties, you know, who will be able to toss something in because we all have different expertise. So,
what has that meant for you being a rural provider, just being able to go day to day and provide what your patients need?
It's made a huge difference. I really feel like it's made me a better provider. It's definitely kept me more enthused about the job. And it's nice to have people who are also interested in the same things that you're interested in, because sometimes in a rural community, you may not have somebody else who is interested, and it's nice to have other just family practitioners who I can talk to about it. So
that was Dr. Leslie Hayes with El Centro Family Health in Española, who has used Project Echo for years. Now let's go back to Dr. Sanjeev Arora, Project Echo's founder. There was an interesting article, and I think you responded to it, but it was a gentleman who wrote, there's a tendency for the enthusiasm to outstrip the evidence. You're mm-hmm. dealing with rural providers who don't have a lot of capacity to do program evaluation to see if it's working. So what are your thoughts about that?
So I do agree to some extent. We have 50 publications, but the amount of evidence required for Echo to become a new operating system for the U.S. healthcare system, which is our dream, a lot more evidence is required. We are in the process of creating it. But as you saw in the U.S. Senate, the Echo Act passed 97-0. And the reason that happened was we are in 30 states, and those physicians who were participating in Echo, they called their congressmen and senators and told them, look, this is important for our communities. But we are very interested in creating more evidence.
Talk about the Echo Act. What does that mean for the program, for you here and for expanding the model?
So the Echo Act is a huge turning point in Echo, because so far, Echo has been just a coalition of willing providers across the country. And of course, because it seems to be working, all the major universities have signed it. So there's one Echo in Massachusetts General at Harvard, Beth Israel Deaconess Harvard, University of Chicago, MD Anderson in Texas, Baylor University, University of Washington, UCSF. That is creating momentum. But there has never been a formal payment mechanism for ECHO? Because
We had a question about that. With our reimbursement model in healthcare, how does ECHO fit into that? Is it difficult?
Megan, it is a big problem because our healthcare system pays providers in the healthcare system for doing things. And so there is a tendency to do a lot of things.
Lots of tests.
Lots of tests, lots of visits. It is not yet a value-based system. So what happens is that often when you don't do the right thing the first time around, it can generate a lot of extra visits, a lot of extra tests, may generate hospitalization, which is all revenue for the health system. ECHO is about providing the right care the first time around. It's about mentoring other providers. It is about making every healthcare worker in our system work at the highest level of their potential. There is no payment mechanism for that yet. But the ECHO Act is moving the healthcare system of the United States. It's directing Health and Human Services in Washington to study ECHO and to try and understand how to incorporate it into the health system of the United States. That's our dream.
It sounds so exciting, but gosh, this is a hard ship to turn around. You know, we're talking bigger than the Titanic turning in a slow ocean.
It is bigger than the Titanic. But the current direction of the U.S. healthcare system is completely unsustainable. Because in the United States, we are spending twice as much on healthcare as any other developed nation. And yet, our outcomes are far inferior than Canada, than Denmark, than United Kingdom. We live not as long as them. And our healthcare is not as good. Patient satisfaction is not as good. So we are getting very poor value for the money we spend. This 18% of our GDP that we spend on healthcare is making our industry non-competitive. A lot of this money is being wasted. It is not having any direct impact on the average U.S. citizen, and this will ultimately become such a big obstacle for our standard of living that the problem will have to be solved.
Do you think ECHO can really impact?
ECHO can have that kind major of impact. But in order for ECHO to really become the operating system, one additional thing has to happen. And that is we as a nation, I mean the people of this country, not just the congressmen and senators, have to insist that we want a value-based system, not a fee-for-service system. Currently, what is happening is we get paid for ringing the bell, and it doesn't matter if it's music or noise, and there's a lot of ringing of the bell going on. And instead, we want to move into a place where all parts of our system are aligned to produce value for the primary customer, which in this case is the patient.
But there are so many entrenched interests who have a stake in maintaining that system.
I do agree that all parts of the system have some entrenched interests, and there is massive inertia to change when many parts of the system don't want change. But I do want to remind you that the United States has faced much bigger problems. There was also the Civil War. And so there are many, many bigger problems we as a nation have solved. It is the greatest country in the world. It has amazing people who follow the rule of law, who have a very strong moral ethic fabric. And ultimately, this will prevail and solve this problem. I guarantee it.
I like your optimism. It's very hopeful. How is Project ECHO funded?
We are funded by our legislature, which has been very generous with us. And without their help, we would not be here. The state Medicaid program funds us. We are also funded by our Department of Health for projects they want to fulfill their mission. We have funding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, from the Helmsley Trust, from the GE Foundation, our largest funder, from Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation, and from Merck Foundation. We don't take money from pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, because of conflicts associated with it. But these are foundations that believe in our mission, and they believe in our goal to reach 1 billion people all over the world, and so they fund us. But in the longer term, we do want it to be embedded in the way the healthcare system in this country is financed.
there's a lot of uncertainty right now in some of those programs. I mean, at the state level with our budget, at the federal level with the budget, with Medicaid, are you concerned about the future of that, some of those funding streams?
I'm concerned about the future of some of the funding streams, but I'm not concerned about the future of ECHO.
Oh, tell me why. How does that compute?
And the reason it computes that way is that we have a very diverse funding base, and the level of interest that is currently in the model from all over the world is absolutely unimaginable. We have insatiable demand for training that we do to other universities from all over the world. To give you an example, 117 academic centers have launched ECHO, but another 200 have already signed collaborative agreements with us and the process of launching many more countries. And this is bigger than just our Medicaid funding becoming less, or it would hurt us. It would be a huge hit, but I don't think it will stop the program.
What's next?
A billion people is a very large number, and we have to set up universities in every country in the world that do ECHO.
You want to reach a billion people?
Yes, by 2025. That's for sure. But a very interesting new avenue has opened up for ECHO, and that's the field of mainstream education. The same problems that exist in healthcare, that is, if you're sitting in a rural part of New Mexico and your doctor doesn't really know how to treat your disease and you can't see a specialist, you cannot get the right care and you suffer. The same problem exists if you're in the same village and your teacher is not a good teacher, because your future is dependent on how good your teacher is, mm-hmm. how good the school is. And so what we have found is the same problem exists, that to train a teacher, they just cannot go on Google and become a better teacher. It's harder. It requires mentorship. It requires training. So we are using the exact same ECHO model to train school teachers to be better school teachers.
Is that being implemented?
Yes, that's already been implemented. 8 or 9 programs by the University of Wyoming. And we are really anxious to implement it in New Mexico and looking for some funding. But the state education department is really keen to partner with us and have approached us. So we hope to launch that. But we've also tried it in India, and it works beautifully. The important point here, Megan, is that new knowledge is being created at an absolutely exponential rate because of many, many forces of information technology, of human genomics, of many, many forces, big data, artificial intelligence, and many forces in play. But getting this knowledge to the last mile of healthcare or the last mile of education is not occurring right now. It's occurring at a linear way as opposed to an exponential way. ECHO is a way to make the dissemination of best practice exponential. And that applies as much to education as it does to healthcare.
Now, when that happens and it's implemented somewhere, is your program here getting, is it like a licensing fee or anything like that? Is that a revenue stream?
No. Okay. We don't charge it.
Okay.
We have that option, but one of the core principles of ECHO is to share with abandon.
Share with abandon.
Yes. We want to.
You have a great way with language.
We want to absolutely, we're trying to start a movement of democratizing knowledge. Because the current business model for knowledge in this world is to monopolize it and sell it in a piecemeal way for high value. That does work because it makes people rich. But there is one problem with the model. The poor get completely disenfranchised. They have no way to access it. They don't have the money. So what we're saying is there's another way to think of knowledge, and that is it's a gift, and we share it for human good. And there is one important difference between knowledge and other types of resources like money, in that knowledge, when shared in an all teach, all learn, it grows. Whereas money, when shared, becomes less. So actually, everybody can become richer in this model, as opposed to just thinking it's an unselfish enterprise. But we're trying to make the world a better place, and we want to do it by sharing with abandon.
Dr. Sanjeev Arora with Project ECHO, thank you for speaking with Sun University Showcase.
Well, thank you, Megan, for the opportunity.
You can find more about Project ECHO at KUNM.org. Now we move to our regular feature here on University Showcase, where we talk with the Daily Lobo about some key stories the paper is following. Joining me is Matt Risen, news editor with the Lobo. Matt, welcome back.
Good to be here.
What have you guys been covering? What do you want to talk about?
One of the bigger things we covered recently was this the ski team being in threat of being cut completely. It was very sudden for them, and so we felt a need to definitely get the story out quickly. You know, I think with athletics, there's a lot going on, and I feel like this story spoke to, like, accountability. And, like, that's something I think the Lobo, I really have always sought to cover at the paper, and I think it's something that needs to continue because I think there's a lot of things happening at this university that could be more transparent. I wish that people who make decisions like this would come forward, first of all, with more warning for the people who are being affected, and also just more publicly talk about reasoning, you know, rather than say, like, this is happening and kind of shutting down the conversation and not really giving much else.
Isn't this the only team at UNM that's won a championship?
Yeah. They have 17 individual champions who have won individual championships on the team for UNM. And then they've also won 13 NCAA trophies. And they have more trophies than any other team combined. Yeah.
Well, I know the budget's a huge uncertainty right now.
The ski team, I think, is a victim of that. Like, it goes all the way to the bottom. I mean, education is everything. It's a shame that there's this thing going on with the governor, it seems like, where it's like a stalemate, like a game of chicken between her and the legislators. That's what it seems like to me, and other people just pay the price.
What else are you guys covering? Are you covering the budget?
I want to look at that more. I was thinking a good follow-up would be a budget breakdown for athletics. See, you know, who's costing the most money, who's making the most money, and just do a full breakdown of that. Because especially with athletics, I mean, there's just so much happening. I mean, as student journalists and as the paper for the university, students read this and they need to know this. They deserve to know where their student fees are going and where their school is putting their priorities.
So, Matt, are there other things coming up?
Yeah, we've been looking into doing a series kind of on UNMPD and where does that, like, responsibilities? I feel like we've all seen the Lobo alerts. You know, we've seen all these things that are happening. I mean, not to mention these Lobo alerts, they come in an hour late, like most times, sometimes even longer. How do we improve this? And I think those are things they need to be asking. We talk about UNMPD. I mean, I don't ever really see them on campus. I mean, I see them in their park, like in the cars in the parking lot. I know they're in there, but we just don't see them on campus. And
I mean, like walking around like a beat cop.
Yeah, exactly. Patrolling, like making people feel safe. We did a story on this lawsuit that is being leveled against UNMPD particular officers because they were caught on tape basically saying how they wanted to kind of railroad these football players in this rape investigation. And a lawyer reached out to me. He gave me the tape. We wrote a story up about it. And so now that we're doing this series, we're looking into it. And these officers are still working at UNMPD, and they're making over $50,000 a year. And they say they got disciplined, but, I mean, they won't tell us how they got disciplined. We've already talked to them about it. We've reached out. I don't know. I think they should answer our questions and kind of, like, I mean, as students and as people, we deserve an answer to why, like, this person tried to take advantage of the system. So I don't know if that has to do with the fact that now it's going to federal court, this whole situation.
Well, that means there'll be more documents to look at.
Yeah, no, definitely. And so we're IPRing those documents because that's another story and that's, like, the next step.
Matt Ryson, news editor with the Daily Lobo. Thanks for coming on University Showcase again.
Thanks for having me.
You can find all our episodes of University Showcase online at KUNM.org. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening.